teenagers and their parents can agree on one thing. It may be that adults really don't understand adolescence. Many moms and dads have been trained to see occasional disobedience, surliness, and risk-taking as either side effects of so-called raging hormones or a means of separating from parental influences. We're sure they think they know everything all of a sudden, when in fact, they're often pretty bewildered by all the changes in their lives. And despite their new focus on navigating their social lives outside the house, they need their parents as much as they ever have. They just need us in different ways. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Adolescents still care a lot about what their parents think. In fact, they are suddenly exquisitely attuned to what everybody else in the world is thinking about them, which is why, while they are learning to use this new superpower, they might seem to overreact when we express disappointment or even say something completely neutral. Psychologist Terry Apter has seen it all. She's a retired fellow of Newnham College, Cambridge, and the author of the book, The Teen Interpreter, A Guide to the Challenges and Joys of Raising Adolescents. Terry, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
When you define adolescence as a normal crisis for families, what do you mean by that?
Well, a crisis is a time when there's a lot going on, there's a lot of change, there's uncertainty, there's also anxiety about the change, and there's a sense of risk and, you know, not knowing what's ahead. But it's also normal. It's not like a crisis of war. It's not like a crisis of an illness. It's normal because it's a phase of development. It used to be thought that adolescence wasn't really a phase of development, that it was sort of artificial, that young people were fully mature by the time they reached puberty, that it was puberty, it was sexual maturity, it was the ability to reproduce. That was what real terms signaled maturity and adulthood, and that it was only modern society sort of inflicted this artificial stage in human development, which was called adolescence, because we didn't want our young people to join adulthood too soon. They had too much to learn. Modern society was much too complicated, and so they needed a long running in period. But now we know that adolescence is a genuine phase of development, not only in humans, but in many other species as well. And it's a time when it's not only our bodies that are changing, but also our brains. So there's really a very distinctive adolescent brain, different from a child's, different from an adult's. And this was missed for many years. I mean, you know, actually this was missed until the very end of the last century, when there were new and very sensitive brain imaging techniques which could look inside the brain. And it used to be thought that at the end of childhood, your brain was fully adult because it was adult size. It weighed the same. But in fact, that weight is actually, it's tangled. There are too many possible connections. There's too much mass. And what happens in adolescence is that the mass itself decreases by about 1.5% a year. But what you gain then are a greater number of connections between the different parts of the brain, so that it begins gradually, very gradually, to work in a more streamlined, efficient way. And in the process, there's a lot of inefficiency, you know, the telltale impulsiveness of teens, the risk-taking, the delight in very big rewards and excitement, rapidity with which they become bored, intolerably bored. All of these things are part of that phase of adolescence in which the brain is changing and developing.
So parents often have the sense that their adolescent children have stopped listening to them or are rejecting them as a means of gaining more adult independence. You found teenagers absolutely still crave their parents' approval and their recognition, but they often feel like their parents haven't truly seen the ways they've changed and matured, and they want them to be that, you know, predictable 8 or 9 year old they once were.
Yes, teens, that complaint, you don't understand me, you don't know anything, you know, there's no point in my telling you anything, you just don't hear it. It could be that kind of thing you might hear from a parent, but you hear it from a teen as well. And what the teen is saying is, you haven't kept up with me. I've changed. I'm not the little child you think you know. I've really changed, and I'm changing, but you are not, you know, as parents of children, parents of babies are so focused on, oh, I want to get to know you. I'm curious about you. I know you're a wonderful person, but I know I don't quite know who you are, and I want to pay attention to you. All that comes very naturally to parents when they're parenting an infant or a child. It doesn't come quite so naturally when the child is a teen. And the teen is very frustrated by this. And a lot of the teen's criticism is not so much, get away from me, I don't want to engage with you. It's an attempt at correcting the parent, reminding the parent that I've changed. And you know, this is difficult because I've changed. I'm not the person you think you know. That's one thing they want to say. But on the other hand, they don't really know who they are. Now, when they were children, their parents were all too willing, you know, were willing to be there and say, help interpret their feelings, help regulate their fears. But when they're much older, children themselves, teens themselves are not very good at giving their parents reminders or clues. They tend to do it in a heavy-handed way, but they're very keen for their parents to work with them to define or grow who they are and their sense of self. And when a parent isn't, in their view, listening, isn't paying enough attention to how they're changing, is making assumptions about who they are, they feel frustrated and they feel alone.
Terry, every parent knows the deep frustration of, like, handing a two-year-old a sliced banana when what they really wanted was the whole banana, and they kind of lose it and rage at us. We don't take that personally. Why do we take it personally when the teenager slams the door and says, you don't understand me, and there's no point in talking to you?
Right. Okay. So this is really important, Chris, because what you've just described is not only how the teen is changing, but how the parent changes in response to the teen. And that's another issue about the crisis and why it seems like a crisis when one person you're close to is undergoing a lot of change, then you have to change too. So getting back to your example, you know, sometimes a parent of a two-year-old will also lose it when the two-year-old is throwing a tantrum, you know, that kind of anxiety and rage and flooding of emotion is contagious. But on the whole, a parent is much better equipped to step back and say, this is just a little child who can't deal with something, doesn't know her own mind, and, you know, this happens. When it's a 14-year-old as opposed to a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old who is doing this, then a parent thinks, this is a real person responding to me, and the responses mean something. They're real. They outline what my teen thinks of me, what my teen feels about me. They outline a rupture in the relationship. I think no parent of a two-year-old or rarely a parent of a two-year-old who's throwing a tantrum would think, this means my child doesn't like me, doesn't want me in their life, and you know, our relationship is ruptured. But they do think that with teens, because they think that the teen knows himself or herself better than the teen actually does.
What is
and
the,
they don't read the frustration.
Yeah, what is the looking glass self, and what does it feel like during those years that it is a dominant part of our experience of being ourselves in the world?
Okay, well, we mentioned the changes in the teen brain, and one of the changes that can be seen with these new imaging techniques is that any kind of social processing about, you know, I'm looking at a face, I'm trying to understand what other people are thinking about me, all of this is in the teen brain. That social processing is much more active than in either a child's or in an adult's. And along with that activity, there's negative stuff, anxiety, you know, a higher pulse rate, perspiration, and self-consciousness, awareness of being seen in a teen is an enormous burden. You know, embarrassment to a teen, that sense of I'm not living up to the right social norms, I'm being seen as sort of slightly off. That is a stronger emotion in teens than almost any other emotions, far stronger than physical fear. And so teens are obsessed with how they appear to other people. And it's called the looking glass self, but it's very different from looking in the mirror and saying, what do I look like? Mirror. They look in the mirror, they want to know what other people see when they look at them. How do other people see me? Am I okay? Do I measure up? And this is an obsession which just, or a focus which rarely leaves them. And it can have a big impact on, you know, a number of things, which I'm sure we'll talk about in terms of their willingness to take risk with friends. You know, they don't want to look as though they're falling short. And they're also very sensitive to faces looking at them. And will often interpret a neutral gaze as something that's disapproving or angry, and then they respond in kind.
Most of us can remember being drawn to risks during our own adolescence like no other time in our lives. And yet when our kids take risks, we find it unbearable because we now understand all the many things that could go wrong. Why are teenagers so uniquely drawn to danger?
Well, this is interesting, and our awareness of what's going on has changed quite a bit. So it used to be thought that teens really weren't intellectually able to assess risk. They just weren't good at thinking about probabilities. Well, it turns out that they're as good as adults are. You know, no one is great when thinking statistically. You have to be trained to do that. So the fact that teens aren't very good at assessing risk, they're just as good or not good as adults. What happens, though, is that their reward centers behave very differently. So their reward centers, you know, what gives them pleasure, what gives you that buzz, what makes you feel life is thrilling, or, you know, things are okay, life is good. For teens, they need a big hit in order to feel that way. They're much less good at enjoying little pleasures in life, the little pleasures that adults tend to enjoy. The coffee in the morning, the stroll, the the sunshine. Teens need something exciting and something new to feel that they're okay. And if they're not getting that, they can really implode with a kind of boredom. Now, this is much stronger, this need for risk and excitement is much stronger with their friends. And their behavior, their risk with their friends, risk-taking is much, much greater. So, a lot of insurance companies will say, we won't insure a teen who is driving with other teens. And there's a reason for that. When they're driving with other teens, they take more risks. And you can see this in, even in a video game, when they're being assessed, are you going to stop at a red light? Are you going to slow down? They do that less. They take, much worse, make many riskier decisions when they're with friends. So parents often worry about a friend who is a bad influence. You know, it's the friend's fault that my teen did that. It's the friend's fault that my teen had too much to drink or did some vandalism or just wasn't thinking. But in fact, it's not a particular friend. It's what's going on in your own teen's brain when you're with any friend. They're focusing on the possibility of that big reward and the possibility of the downside of things just falls by the wayside. They just don't see it.
Okay, they will mess up from time to time, and old school parenting called for punishing teen behavior that we as parents find unacceptable. How can harsh discipline backfire?
Well, one of the things, one of the reasons it can backfire or at least be ineffective is because of the way teens look at reward and discount the downside. So it's much better to say to a teen, if you behave well, if you show me you've overcome this tendency to behave badly and you behave well, then I'll give you a reward rather than that I'll punish you by grounding you or taking your phone away or making you do chores or something like that. So that's one thing quite related to the perception of risk element and the need and the reward center. But it can backfire in other ways too. First of all, physical punishment is problematic at any age. But for a teen, it's so humiliating and so infuriating that it will just drive a chasm between teen and parent. It's really a dangerous route for the parent to take. But also shouting. I mean, when a teen is excited in a negative sense, alarmed. They're very quick to escalate that alarm, that alert, and very, very slow to go back to what we would think of as baseline. And when they're in that heightened state of alarm, as they will be when anyone is shouting at them, I think we all are, they don't hear anything other than the anger. They can only look at the emotional side of things. So they don't hear what the parent is saying. And often a lot of things that parents say to them sound coercive. Why did you do that? What were you thinking? A parent in a way is genuinely asking, why you, my teen who is generally sensible, why are you doing these ridiculous things? Or, what were you thinking? In a way, it's a genuine question from the parent's point of view, but you can see, I think, why it sounds coercive and punitive from the teen's point of view? And they can't really answer that question. You know, they didn't think and they were stupid because they're teens. And though they're very, very smart, they sometimes do stupid things.
Many experts have noted that the documented rise in adolescent mental illnesses seems to parallel the rise of social media. First of all, if teenagers know that the images they see on, say, Instagram are not real, why do they still tend to judge themselves against them?
It's a puzzle. I mean, teens are very articulate about when they look at social media and they look at profiles that they think are very glamorous. And they'll say, I know I'm looking at masks. I know I don't really know these people. And nonetheless, I kind of go into a zone when I think they're wonderful and I know I'm never going to measure up. I know I'm looking at their outsides and I'm measuring my insides against their outsides, but that doesn't help. And part of it is, I think that they're looking at how their friends will see them, and they care about their looking glass self, and they want to be seen in this glamorized way, or they would love to be seen in this glamorized way, but they know they can't, and they know themselves too well to believe that they could, or, you know, take in that kind of glamour in themselves. So, But they use social media in many different ways, so that glazed scrolling, one glamorous profile after another, can be quite deadening, really pulls them down. And they think, you know, oh, if only I could look like that on social media, my friends would approve of me and I'd be much happier. But there are many more positive ways of engaging in social media. So, you know, during the lockdowns, during school closures, that concern about social media being very bad for teens sort of changed. And people were, parents, teachers, scientists were saying, oh, thank goodness they have this way of communicating with other people. And it did go some way to protect some teens from horrible social isolation and a sense of missing out and depriving them of that feedback that they need all the time. But, you know, your point about that parallel between the rise of social media and the increase in teen mental problems, particularly suicide and self-harm, well, there is a parallel, indeed. So rates of teen suicide were falling from 1990 to 2000, and then around 2007, so here we are at the sort of start of the smartphone, they started rising again. And they've risen significantly. I mean, the big headline figure is they've risen 60% from 2007 to 2018, which means in effect that it's from 6.8 per 100,000, it's now 10.7 per 100,000. It's really scary. But when you look at it in detail and closely, it isn't a simple causal effect. I mean, teens who are disturbed will go to sites that are disturbing, will go to sites about self-harm. You know, teens who are very depressed will choose friends who are depressed. Teens who feel like they're misfits will choose another friend as a misfit. So it seems to be related, but it depends how you use social media. And it also depends on the causes work both ways.
You also note that research does not find that taking social media away from an already anxious or depressed teenager makes things better.
Well, that's because social media is so integrated into a teen's life. This is the way they communicate with their friends. This is the way they keep up to date with what's going on. And so if you, in this culture, if you, you know, in this society, if you take social media away, they will feel they'll be in a great disadvantage socially. They won't know what's going on. They won't know when their friends are meeting. They won't know what their friends are thinking. They might not know what television shows to watch or what things to stream. So I think, you know, it's tricky. And I've done some research looking at how, given social media, given the is so ingrained in their lives, and it's not helpful just to take it away, and even limiting it usually leads to a lot of altercations and can make the teen parent relationship work. I've been looking at how you can make social media a little bit healthier for teens. And one way to do that is to just engage them enough to say, well, what are you really interested in? What do you value? And then supply them with a list of profiles they might follow. I mean, really meaty ones about people doing important things, things that you know from having spoken to them that they will value. And when we did this in five different schools, we found that after 9 months, 6 months, 9 months, they were much better equipped at managing their social media. They could use it to find out more about what they wanted to do in the future, how to go about it. And they would clean up their social media feeds. They said they realized that they had been spending a lot of time admiring people or obsessing about people and envying people they didn't really admire. And they called this cringe binging. And they were able to stop doing that and move it forward a bit. I mean, it would be really nice if internet companies would manage the algorithms in a way that would help teens with this enterprise, but it looks as though there are ways that we can help teens sort of clean up their social media feed, making it that much healthier for them.
Terry, what's going on with teenagers who seem to have nothing but criticism for their parents for a couple of years?
Well, certainly that will be recognizable by many parents. I can't say everything I say is wrong. I can't say anything without her complaining about me. I think it will be very helpful if parents sort of retune their response to this and start and ask teens, you know, clearly I'm annoying you. Can you help me out here? What is it that would help you? That's one thing they can do, really ask the teen to help them. If there's something I'm doing that's really annoying you or, you know, making things worse, let's talk about it. Just give me a clue and start a conversation like that. The other thing is to listen for identity reminders, which we talked about before. I'm not the little child you think you know. I'm really different. Please keep up with me. So a lot of the criticisms are, you know, you're not listening to me. You don't appreciate, understand who I am. So listen out for those. And also, be strong enough to listen to those negative feelings, because when you listen and when you keep calm enough to hear it, you can really help grow that teen brain so that it's much better at regulating feelings, and that means regulating impulses as well, and helping the teen grow into that adult who is not going to take silly risks and who is not going to be overly excited by just anything, and who can, who has a brain that's much more efficient and more integrated, and that's, of course, what we want.
Okay, so before I let you go quickly, how long do we need to hold out before that happens? How long can we realistically expect adolescence to last, knowing what we know now about brain science?
Okay, well, the gloomy news is that in terms of when is the brain fully adult, I'm afraid it's not to the age of 24, but it is a process. And so, by the age of 19, 20, they may have patches of immaturity, but they'll be much better. But they will still need that sort of parental scaffolding from time to time. And what also helps is that these good conversations with parents, the parents holding them in mind, the parents being warmly curious about them and keen to get to know this new person, that really does accelerate the brain growth. So maybe you won't have to wait until the age of 24.
Psychologist Terry Apter is a retired fellow of Newnham College, Cambridge, and author of the book The Teen Interpreter, a guide to the challenges and joys of raising adolescents. Terry, thanks very much for making time for us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. The podcast is available wherever you get podcasts. You just search for KERA Think and subscribe, or listen to any show on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.